Welcome to a new episode of Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is from the Batman Family Reunion, Paul Keen. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
You're really helping me out. I'm going to tell people right now, this is an emergency record. It is not part of the quarterly schedule that I usually have for this show. It's a bonus episode because I couldn't make the actual shows that were supposed to be this Tuesday happen because life, I suppose.
Well, you shouldn't let everybody know that under the hood of the podcast world, you know?
Well, you know, some people think I'm a production machine, but sometimes I've said yes to too many things. So thank you for being with me. We won't waste any time here. We'll go right into our randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. Prior to the recording, we rolled up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally a panel, the discrete unit of comic book storytelling. In this case, we rolled the year 1953, the month of March. Among all the comics out that month, The Revolving Finger falls on Strange Adventures number 32, actual cover date May, by writer Sid Gerson and artists Frank Giacoya and Seymour Barry. It's going to be page 27 of 27 and panel 4 of 4. It's the very end of the issue, panel 4 of 4. And you'll find the panel, the page, maybe a little bit more in the show notes, the gallery at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Well, let me look at this panel here. Okay. Well, first of all, Paul, this is like the oldest comic we've done in a while.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I was excited. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a 1940s one we did like 12 episodes ago, which is like 3 years ago as the podcast flies. So, but you like older comics.
I do.
And it's an anthology book. So are you a fan of anthology books like Strange Adventures? I know Batman Family is obviously an anthology book, but it's a focused superhero one. Like this, this stuff is short stories. What's your history with this kind of stuff?
Well, I like, you know, getting bang for the buck when you get your comic book, right, when you're a kid. And so, you know, when I was growing up, the 100-page Super Spectaculars were coming out, and I got a number of them off the stands, and they were probably among the first back issues that I ever collected. I love them. You know, and similar to the early Batman Family, you got a news story generally, and then you got a bunch of reprints that were fantastic to learn about. I mean, you know, they're great, and I love all the family titles. I had them all, even Super Team Family. I even had a couple Tarzan Family, even though that's not.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then among the Dollar Comics, like Adventure and World's Finest, when they went to Dollar Comics, they were like a couple of my favorite titles, given the variety there. You know, there were other ones like Secret Origins and Wanted. Again, with a lot of reprint material. And then, of course, some of the best anthologies were Christmas and other holiday stories. But, you know, the ones like this, like House of Secrets, House of Mystery, you know, I never bought them as a kid. But now, you know, I have a couple of those omnibus and I really enjoy them because you can read them in chunks, right? You can, if you want to read for 10 minutes, you read for 10 minutes. If you want to read for an hour, you can read an hour and you get a variety of stories throughout it. I never was a big fan of war comics, but a few years ago I saw the entire run of All Out War, which was a dollar comic, only 6 issues came out. We got them cheap a number of years ago, and I read them, but I did enjoy them, especially this character called the Viking Commando.
Oh yeah, he's cool.
He's so cool. I liked him so much I had to seek out his final appearance in like The Unknown Soldier. It was like a two-parter. But DC, I always felt, had, you know, the most commitment to the anthology-style book. And even today, I feel like they keep trying various formats, right? With the quarterly, you know, holiday-type books that they do now, which generally I enjoy, you know, but...
Yeah, they'll do, like, LGBT issues or it's Black History Month, and they'll do stuff like that. And even in their Vertigo books or their more horror books, you know, you would get revivals of Strange Adventures, and it'd be all new by writers that we love today or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I think about other publishers and Marvel, I mean, Marvel didn't have as many. The two that come to my mind are Marvel Fanfare, right, which I did like, and like some of them quite a bit. Some were not as good. You know, we actually talk about Marvel Fanfare a little bit in the upcoming episode of Batman Family Reunion, because we do a feature on Michael Golden, and he did the art in the first two issues of that. And then Marvel Comics Presents, right? That was like a Wolverine. And I lost interest in Wolverine, I don't know, by the mid-90s. But I looked that up before, and that ran 175 issues, which I was amazed.
Yeah, I bought that for a while.
I bought it for a while, too. And then I like I said, I lost interest in a lot of that stuff. But I was like, wow. And then the only other Marvel I could think of was something like Solo Avengers and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Charlton had a lot of them as well. Yeah. You know, obviously, if you go back, EC Comics,
sure,
was the big player in the anthology market. You know, you talked about War Comics. I actually really like War Comics, but it's not something that as a kid I would have been interested in. You know, as an adult, there's a lot of these features that I find very interesting, and the ones that are continuing. You know, the War of the Time Forgot, or. Or like Viking Commando, they put like a weird spin on it. And of course, I used to have a show about romance comics, which for the most part are anthologies. So
that's true.
That's true. But this is Strange Adventures is it's sci-fi. So we're in the 50s. That makes sense. Sci-fi was a big thing. The Rocket Age, the Atomic Age.
Yep.
So we're getting a lot of that. And this panel obviously comes from one of those stories. Now, the comic was fronted by Captain Comet. There's somebody
The cover.
Oh yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
And the cover is awesome.
It's also got a gorilla, so yeah, you know, pure 50s. Yeah, Captain Comet is the one that brings you back to the book month after month, maybe, and then you get three other stories, you know, anthology style. So we rolled a later page. No Captain Comet today.
What I found interesting when I looked up this story, because I was, you know, I did my preparation. I'm going to try to find the actual story because I'm very intrigued what the story was. It's only been reprinted once in The Unexpected, 1968. And none of the other stories were reprinted, which says something that, you know, this story was highly regarded. I'd love to read some of those old Captain Comet stories, because finding out how he got out of exchanging brains with a gorilla is now high on my list.
I'll make that happen for you. All right. Well, let's talk about the panel. Let's describe the panel, and then we can talk more about who did it and, you know, what it evokes. You know, the name of the story is Probability Zero. Mm-hmm. I'll just say that as the only context at this point. Paul, will you do the honors?
I'd be delighted to. So we're looking at this panel. It is rectangular, almost square, with its height slightly more than its width. The background is a barren white, kind of like Vince Coletta had been there erasing, or perhaps it's making us focus on the only two items that we do see. The first is a man's right arm. His shoulder is in the bottom right, with his hand reaching up to the middle of the panel. It appears he's lying face down on the ground with his arm outstretched. He's wearing a brown pinstripe suit jacket with the cuff of his white shirt showing at the wrist. There is no motion implied by the arm, and with a hint of defeat or frustration, since his hand is in a fist down position on the ground. Our view is drawn up by his arm past his fist, where we find the other focus of the panel. Here, there are remnants of some item or device that has clearly been broken. There's a red band or strap surrounded by debris, springs, glass, what looks to be a wire, and some other unknown detritus. The caption at the top of the panel, in a yellow text box, to contrast with the white background, reads as follows. As its last act, the probability machine smashes to pieces on the floor, never to work again. And our eye is finally drawn to the ominous caption below the fragments, the end.
Right, okay. You did a good job there. Even made me question some of my assumptions about the panel. Well, you said it was the right arm, and I was like, is it? That, in my mind, someone prone like that, I thought, was face down. So there would be like the left arm. But I think you're right. The hand. Well,
I look at his thumb. I think he's either dead or knocked out. Because if you look at the far bottom, I'm looking at my iPad. Look at the far bottom right. I think that far bottom right, right by the page number 6, is the top right part of his head with his ear sticking there. And And his right hand, his thumb, is at the bottom, lying on the ground.
Okay.
So that's why I figured it was his right arm.
Right. To me, the color was so close to the jacket, sort of orangey tan, that I thought maybe that was like, you know, the back of the jacket, like a buttock.
I did too. Of course, you know, where else do we pour over you know, 70-year-old comic book panels, but I was looking at it last night, blowing it up on my iPad, and I'm like, I think that's his head.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. He's face down, and his head is pointing downward from the page.
Right.
Either way, you don't want to see the face of a dead man in, you know, a code-approved comic or, you know, at that point in history. I did a little bit of research on just, like, the credits on this. Sid Gerson, who is the writer here, is not a name I recognized.
Nor I.
Now, he wrote some 9 stories for Mystery in Space, Strange Adventures, and the like. I don't know, submitted some scripts or something. Who else? Frank Giacoia is more recognizable, obviously.
Absolutely.
He worked on comics and comic strips from the Golden Age right up to the early 80s. He was one of Jack Kirby's principal inkers.
I found that interesting. He did the pencils for this because I knew him more as an inker.
Right. He's like he transitioned into inking, but there's a lot of penciling credits in the early days.
Fascinating.
Yeah. His inker, speaking of inkers, is Seymour, a.k.a. Cy Barry. So Cy Barry is perhaps more known than Seymour Barry. He worked on The Phantom for the better part of 3 decades. He worked on a lot of Golden Age and 50s DC comics, including Rex the Wonder Dog and some early Phantom Stranger stuff. Yeah, by the 50s, he was considered one of the best inkers in the business, which is how he spun off into more lucrative newspaper strip assignments like The Phantom, like Tarzan. So his name is better known maybe for the newspaper syndicates than the comics during our lifetimes. Some good cred in terms of art here, classic illustration. So let's talk about the content, all right? Mm-hmm. What do you want to address first?
I do think the stark white, I mean, I made a joke about the stark white background, but I do think that gives it like a sense of finality, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the last panel of the story. You know, the guy is, like we said, either dead or unconscious. I'm very interested in the part of the text that says, as its last act, the probability machine smashes to pieces. And that implied to me almost a sentience to the machine. Did you get that feeling?
Yes, that's the one of the more mysterious elements here. So I know the context. I didn't want to read the whole story, but I had to pick up the page, you know, for the gallery. I'll keep the context for later. But yes, it does imply that the machine is making decisions.
Yes.
Not the man. I also like the open frame concept of this, especially in context with when you flip the pages of this actual comic. This one has no border. It's not just white. It doesn't have a border. And I can confirm that most of the comic is very much like what you've seen of 1950s comics. It's crammed with information. There's lots of text, lots of claustrophobic panels with lots of stuff going on in each, a lot of panels every page, and, you know, a compressed storytelling style, right? Wow. So ending on a panel like this is a relief. I feel like, you know, like that device, if it smashed itself to pieces, if it committed a suicide, you know, what is the story that at the end we get a sort of relief from whatever shenanigans were happening, right?
Yeah, it's almost like, thank goodness the machine broke.
It's like the machine is, it's the whiteout of going to the afterlife. It's the, you know, there's something to that, that I think doing like a white panel with very few elements, like a minimalist thing, really works in the context of the story, and I think it looks good as well for us who are looking at it, you know, out of context. You know, it's the soul exiting the body, either of the man or the machine or both, you know. And if it's a probability machine, think of it this way. Probability ceases to exist, so there's a nothingness. Mm. Nothing is probable or possible. So
almost like a 0 hour.
Well, it's called probability zero, right? So suddenly the zeroness of it comes full bloom and we get this white panel. So I think that's one of the more interesting elements in this.
Oh, well, I found myself wondering over the last couple of days, like, you know, what I'm super interested in what this machine was. Was it a predictive machine? Like he, you know, could use it to predict horse races and make money, did using it to invest in the stock market? Or rather than predictive, was it able to affect the outcome, change the probability of things, you know?
Right.
And I kind of imagine that the man has been using the device to somehow better his life, like kind of like a deal with the devil, and you know, to whether it's gambling or you know, predicting things. And then he somehow gets his comeuppance when the device is broken, or perhaps the device gets broken because he pushes it too far. I don't know. I'm fascinated.
Right. This, you know, and you like, need these stories to have that ironic twist at the end, right?
Yeah. You know,
and I love that the end caption, particularly because it's written on a folded piece of paper, which is a classic thing. You see that in a lot of comics. The end is like on a sort of little scroll or something. Mm-hmm. But here it looks like it's marking evidence. You know, like those things that they put around
blood spatter. That's a great. Yeah, it does. It's like this is the end. Yeah, like an A for the evidence that someone took right. a picture.
The CSI put the end there. to highlight it, because it's not in the corner, you know, they like pushed it up a little bit. So yeah. It feels like now it's part of the mise-en-scene. It feels like it's part of the debris. Put this little post-it here. Doop. The debris, you mentioned all the things that we could see. They're only like, there's just the red band is the only color and the rest is just like scribbles. Yeah. is that like a ribbon, like inside, you know, you get that inside a watch or inside a mechanism?
I was trying to, I mean, I, you know, blowing it up doesn't really help. Right.
No,
to look at it. I was imagining it to be like a belt in a car, you know, almost like the but I don't know. It could be whether it's inside or outside of the device. It, you know, obviously we don't know because we haven't seen what the constructed device looked like.
And I like how there's like one piece of glass kind of looks like a little lightning bolt as well.
So yeah.
it evokes something electric. It evokes, you know, it's not like a magical device. Like that could be just like, I don't know, carpet or, but no, it's springs, you know, those little squiggles, yeah. They're springs.
Like the watch works.
Yeah, it's mechanical, but it's also maybe electric and there's power in there. One of the things that I picked up on in this is a quirk of the coloring. They put a little dab of red on the hand.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Right? Yeah, there's just like a little mark on the hand, which a little dot of red in there, which might indicate that, you know, this thing exploded in his hand or something. And he's got like a little cut. I don't know if that's a fact from the story, but.
That is cool. That is, you know, and I find it interesting that, you know, his hand is in a fist. Like, it's not that it's open trying to recover the device. But the fact that his hand is in a fist on the ground, I mean, normally if, you know, somebody's lying on the ground, their hand would be open. So I'm wondering what brings him to have his hand in a fist. And is it rigor mortis? Or is he still holding something inside his fist that we don't see, you know?
Good cloth physics as well on this. You know, you can tell you got like people with real illustrative skills were working in comics back then, more so than today, maybe. Cloth is one of the things that is hard to draw. You know, so you get a lot of, like how the jacket is riding up, like the sleeve is pulled back as he stretched out, which,
you know, does show the skill of the artist for sure. And I do like, I mean, it is when you wear a suit jacket with a shirt underneath, your little white cuff does poke out most of the time. Yeah. So I do like that touch.
Yeah. And it is all riding up because there's much too much flesh coming out of the cuff as well. And as a very tall person, I relate to this potentially dead man. Oh, are you ready for the context?
I would love to hear the context.
You're right on a number of points. And even so, I only read the last page. Okay, so I flipped through it quickly, looked at the last page, and from the last, it's so compressed that the last page told me a lot. But
I imagine, yeah.
This is a probability machine. It can speak. It Ooh. Has the Scarlet Witch's powers, essentially. It's changing probability. From what I gather, its inventor made himself powerful by closing the gap between long odds. So things that aren't just like the Scarlet Witch, like this stuff really shouldn't happen, has a very low probability of ever happening, but it's yep. you know, it's not zero probability. He used that power to make himself rich, make himself powerful,
yep.
that kind
yep.
of stuff. And on the last page, the machine, against all odds, right, develops sentience and
wow.
and morality. And he realizes this is wrong and that the only way out for itself is to destroy itself before this guy, you know. And against all odds, it makes the air escape the room.
I love it.
So that kills the dude. So, right? It's pretty close to the stuff that you've been intuiting.
Wow, that's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, that's really a sophisticated use of probability. I mean, I was a math major in college, right? So I know a lot about probability and things like that. And a lot of times people don't fully understand the probability to talk about certainty. And to describe it like that, saying, you know, against all odds, the air exits the room, right? That's really a cool use of probability. So obviously, this fellow Sid Gerson wanted to use that. Maybe he took a course in probability.
Yeah, I was almost expecting him to be maybe an actual science fiction writer.
Yeah,
you know, like Hamilton, who was also writing for DC around this time.
Right, Edward Hamilton. Did you find anything else about him?
No. He doesn't have like his only Wikipedia entries are comic book related, like the DC Wikipedia or the comic book Wikipedia. So I couldn't find. And you know what? Maybe he's working under a pseudonym, which a lot of people were doing back then. And he has other things. No idea. If people know at home, I'm sure you will educate me in the comments section. But yeah, I mean, this is a proper monkey's paw kind of take on, you know, on probabilities and physics. Because there is a non-zero probability that when I sit down on a chair, all my atoms will line up and I'll fall underneath, go through the chair, you know, whoop, just like the Flash running,
right,
vibrating his molecules. There is a very low probability of something like that happening. This story knows that, and it's playing around with it, although it goes a bit far. I don't think the probability of a handheld device becoming spontaneously sentient and moral is anything but zero. I don't think that's it's so close to zero, it'll never happen. No, it has to be zero, right?
They do have to have some speculative element, right?
Right, right. It is a comic book story. The device.
Well, you've inspired me even more, because tomorrow I'm probably going to go over to a small comic show and I'm going to see if any of them have the reprint of this. Can't be very expensive, you know. The Unexpected number 106 from 1968. I'm going to see if I can find that. So yeah, that's cool.
That may be more affordable than the 1952 comic, or findable. I say affordable, but findable.
Right, exactly.
Good luck with that quest. any last thoughts on the panel before we go?
No, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun to have the final panel of a story. I thought that by itself was fun, and the fact that it's in this genre was really cool, and so I really enjoyed it. So thanks for giving me the opportunity. That was super cool.
Yeah, I think we've had the first panel of a story more than once, probably, because if you roll up the first page and it's a splash page, then
There's only one panel.
Yeah, there's only one panel. So that one comes up more than it should. But the last panel of a story, especially a crammed story like this, I think this is a first. And it was indeed fun. Well, thank you, Paul. Gee, tell people what you're working on right now. What can we expect from Batman Family Reunion?
Well, very exciting times coming up. We have one more issue, number 16 of the old DC Giant size. And then number 17 starts Dollar Comics. And so we're very excited to get into the Dollar Comics era of Batman Family. Now, there's only four more issues of Batman Family proper, but then we'll jump into the 15 issues of Detective that starred the Batman Family and continue on till the end. So Sean and I are both very excited. We've had a number of guests, which has been really fun. We had a variety. We finally got our first letter writer on the show that dropped this past month, and that was super cool because he's actually a comics professional. Craig Boldman. He wrote some Superman stories in the 80s and for Julie Schwartz before the Byrne revamp, and then he has been writing and drawing Archie comics for, you know, years, 20 years. So I thought that was really cool to have him in the show, as well as Jim Beard. That was our last episode. So a lot of fun stuff coming up, and so hope people tune in.
Yeah, it's all at fireandwaterpodcast.com. We're all on the same network here, so you don't have to go very far to find it. All right, I'll let you go back to the margins. We'll listen to a short promo, and I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode. Thanks again.
Thank you. Hey, Sean, do you want to go over the checklist to make sure we are ready for the next phase of the Batman Family Reunion?
Sure thing, Paul.
Robin and Batgirl in team-up action?
Check.
Fried chicken?
Check. Man-Bat fighting a were-jaguar?
Check.
Deviled eggs?
Check. Potato salad?
Check.
Without the raisins?
Of course.
The Huntress fighting Catwoman and Poison Ivy?
Check. Lemonade?
Check.
Alfred and Commissioner Gordon keeping a secret from Bruce Wayne?
Check and check. Reprints or all new stories?
New stories and reprints until issue 10, and then nothing but brand new stories from there on out. Giant-sized issues?
A mere giant size until issue 16, and then Dollar Comics from issue 17 to 20 through the end of the run in Detective. Guest list?
Absolutely. We are having a number of Bat relatives visit the reunion, so listen in for your favorite Bat cousin.
All right, great. Then we're all ready for the Batman Family Reunion podcast, where we talk about Batman Family, the great comic book from the 70s and 80s. We'll discuss not only the stories, but also the text pages and ads, and we'll also find out what the Batman Family was doing on the newsstands that month.
And since this is a reunion, we're inviting all of you, the Bat kinfolk, to listen in and to be part of the show.
Look for the Batman Family Reunion podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
And now your feedback on our previous episode, comment by comment. That previous episode was called Gripping Aquaman with my special guest, Chad Bokelman. We looked at Aquaman number 57 or 8 panel therein by artist Jim Aparo. Chris Franklin had this to say, says, not kink shaming anyone, but I never get the whole tentacle hentai thing. It just never crosses my mind. I have to say, a lot of people brought this up. I wasn't really talking about hentai necessarily, but just like, you know, a bit of a choking the chicken kind of position for the King of the Seven Seas. Anyway, Chris goes on, he says, Aparo's Aquaman almost always had that tuft of hair, free-flowing motion. It was almost like Superman's and Batman's capes in a lot of ways, or Firestorm's puffy sleeves, if you will, used to show kinetic action and motion. He seemed to be the first artist to really make it look kind of wavy, almost curly. Of course, there's a lot of tension and implied danger in this one. Aparo was just the total package. He tells a whole story in this one thin, isolated panel. The grip Aquaman has, the word balloon, which he probably lettered, the shock on Arthur's face that his telepathy isn't cutting it here. Just wonderful stuff. Moving on to Ange, says, indeed a very good panel for the randomizer to fall upon, and grateful for the whole page in the gallery to help put it in context. I wonder if artists cringe at underwater books, as they constantly have to convey that environment, either through hair or swirls or flows of algae. For me, the thing that sells this is the eyes on Aquaman. Two circles, two dots, and yet laden with fear. This is our hero afraid he's going to be killed, punctuated by the word balloon. Rob Kelly says, hey, stay on your side of the street, randomizer. Jim Aparo, doing his own lettering, really helped him with composition on any given panel or page. He didn't have to guess or hope where someone else was going to put the captions or balloons. I find that makes his pages enormously smooth to look at. The eye glides seamlessly from one part to the next, panel to panel, page to page. This panel is a great example of that. Not to mention the marvelous inking, which he also did himself, which features a nice variation of line weights to give the whole thing a nice sense of depth. Pun not intended, I imagine. Chad touched on the coloring as well. It had to be hard for anyone coloring an Aquaman comic not to get bogged down in nothing but browns and greens when he's underwater. As mentioned, his blonde hair and orange tunic really pop. And that's a really good point about lettering. I've come up through European comics, and I find it strange that letterer is a separate job at all. Today, fine, because it's done with fonts, I guess, but back in the day, a lot of cartoonists just did their own thing, but you had maybe the American model was more of an assembly line. Paul Kien says, great episode. Chad was a great guest with insightful comments. I also didn't get the sexual innuendo until you guys talked about it. Now I cannot not see it. Sorry. Sorry, Paul. But as you know, I don't get lots of things. Well, I think this episode sort of redeemed you on that front. Anyway, he goes on. He says, the hair flowing motion really does it for me, too. Just a masterclass on how to convey motion. And, you know, maybe us French speakers, we're not as Puritan as English speakers generally. So maybe that's why my mind is in the gutter. Maybe I've been trained by the hot squad over at Hot or not. I don't know. But I see the double entendres much more easily, you know. Speaking of double entendres, here's Martin Gray. We'll see if he has one. He says, I'm another who never equates tentacles with willies, and I was raised by the in-your-end-oh world of carry-on films. Well, that's a good training ground for innuendo. He says, apparently, it's from manga, something I've never bothered with. Top episode, great insights from you both, but that panel wasn't half a gift. Yeah, I mean, sometimes the randomizer, you know, you have to work for it. Other times, it's a full spread. It's a full buffet. Well, all right. Just a quick mention of our Patreon, if you like this sort of content and want more like it. As you can imagine, it costs a lot to host all of these podcasts on the network. So every little bit helps and is appreciated. You can go to patreon.com/FW podcasts, leave a one-time or a monthly donation that helps us keep afloat. Again, not a Aquaman pun. Okay. As ever, a reminder that if you would like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You'll be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. My thanks again to my guest, Paul Keen. And until we refill that seat, the panel is open.